It's ad break time. I am pleased to announce the Beyond Solitaire podcast remains proudly sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they are up to amazing things. If you want to improve your own skills as a game designer, you should absolutely sign up for Loyola Santa's upcoming class, The Art of Game Crafting, for your classroom, boardroom, or game night. The class starts October 9th, and Aloy is a great teacher. You'll also get credit towards a certificate in applied game design, which is offered as a collaboration between CMU and Gen Con. CLGS's latest game, 500-Year-Old Vampire, just finished a very successful campaign, but if you forgot to back it, you can now pre-order through BackerKit. The link is in the show notes. I also want to plug my own Patreon. Your support means a lot to me, both emotionally and financially. Patreon money is what makes it possible to keep improving my channel by upgrading the equipment, and I'm also hoping to increase the amount of videos I can publish over the course of the next year. If you want to help out, head over to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. For now, though, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, it's Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and I'm here with a special guest, Cole Worley, designer, genius from Leader Games and also Worley Gig. How are you doing, Cole?
I'm doing well, Liz. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's super good to talk to you. It's been a while since you were on the podcast. I mean, we talk fairly often, but
yeah, but
one of my favorite episodes was with you. So I think that we will just reprise that.
easy.
No problem.
Star is setting the bar so high.
Let's just talk basic news first, which is that you have an upcoming release from Worley Gig. I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it right now.
Awesome. Yeah, we have on the 17th of October, we are going to be launching our next campaign. It's for a game called Molly House by a brilliant young designer named Joe Kelly with some additional design by myself. And it is in some ways a very different kind of game from the games we normally release. It's shorter. It's an hour. It's spirited, lighthearted a little bit, easy to pick up, easy to play with a group of folks who don't normally play historical games. But in other ways is so deeply like a Worley Gig game. It is exploring an interesting slice of history. It's about queer culture in the early 18th century, which is such an interesting slice because a lot of queer history has been completely kind of bulldozed. It's the sort of history that gets destroyed. But this little slice, the slice about Molly Houses in the early 18th century, we do actually know a lot about. And so it is a kind of sensitive reconstruction of that period. And it's about, it's also about like the history of policing and of parties and of different ways of thinking about identity long before categories, even like queer or trans even existed. How are people sorting out and negotiating those identities? And I just adore it to death. And so we'll be launching on the 17th. We've got lots of interesting things to show people. And I'm so excited to see how this game does.
Fantastic. I also want to flag that this is a Zenobia finalist game that is now making out in a publication. And by the time this episode runs, applications for Zenobia 2 will be open. They're open through the end of October. So, Cole, do you want to just say something really quick about finding this game as part of that process so that people can hopefully feel inspired?
Yeah, the Zenobia contest for anyone who is thinking about working on a subject like this or who isn't, you know, if they don't see themselves reflected in the bios of a lot of people who work in historical board gaming, the Zenobia contest is for you. It's a two effort contest. One part is, of course, the contest. The other part is this really fabulous mentorship program. It was through that program that I met Joe and helped them on their design over many, many months. And it's just a wonderful nurturing space to take these projects through something like the kind of pre-publication process. I think there were 8 or 9 finalists for the initial contest. Most of them have been signed by companies. And, you know, Molly House is not the first one that's going to be on crowdfunding or the first one that's going to get published probably.
Fantastic. Yes. And I'm so happy for Joe. They were great to talk to you during the contest. Actually, this has me thinking like I need to just have them on for another interview now, but it just feeds itself.
Yep, exactly. My job's done.
But I do want to talk today a lot about Oath. So Oath, I think, is one of your riskier games in a lot of ways, because instead of grounding itself in a very specific element of history, it's an attempt to be both a game and kind of like a, I don't know if it's a study, like a representation of history proceeding along from game to game. And I guess I know that we've got some expansion stuff coming for it in the future. Do you want to talk about that like as much as you're able?
Well, I mean, here's how I'll frame the expansion things. We're working on an expansion, by which I mean, now that Oath has been around for a bit and we've seen people play it. And one thing I love about running to people at shows, so I love going to shows because you get to see all of these things made physical. All these, like, these people bump into you and they talk about projects you've worked on. You think, oh, that project was just a PDF really for me. But it's something very real for this person. And you meet fans of your work. It's wonderful. I meet lots of people who play Root and they have Root nights and things like that. But the Oath fans are different because they'll tell me, oh, I'm 30 games in and this is happening. And they actually just launch directly into the narrative. No one ever says like, oh, I really like this part of Oath's design. What they instead say is like, oh, this thing happened in the game. And there's a line between the design and the storytelling that is like, it's gotten very thin. And that's wonderful. And now that I've seen Oath kind of grow in its players and in its storytelling, it started giving us ideas about how we want to expand it, improve it. It's an interesting project because we of course have never planned to expand it. I approach every project generally with some exceptions as assume this is my only chance to do this thing, so I'm going to try to do it as best as I can. And with Oath, it does seem like the audience wants us to spend more time there. And whether or not a game gets attention, it's always a negotiation between what we're working on, what the audience wants, what we think the game might need. And having seen and played a lot more Oath and thought about it, I do think that there are places where the game can kind of grow and expand. This is not an easy thing for me to convince people of, because Oath is, as you said, like probably the riskiest project we had ever worked on.
Yes, and so I want to talk more about why that is, but I do want to disclose now. I can only disclose so much, even to you, Cole. But I spent this morning playing Oath, but it's not Oath as anybody knows it, except for Ricky Royal and me. And we'll have that meeting later. And that's all I'm going to say about that. So I'm particularly interested in this project for personal reasons.
Liz just booked a third appearance with me in 6 months where we're going to be talking about what she's working on.
Yeah, so we have to invite Ricky.
Yeah.
Who should always be invited to everything anyway. He's a delight.
Yes, that's true.
But, okay, so in what sense were you hoping for Oath to sort of evoke the passage of time and like an mm-hmm. ongoing story? And then how does that compare to how it has turned out? Would you say that, like, what was your thesis, your hope for this game, and then has it lived mm-hmm. up to it?
Well, you know, Oath had, it's funny, a lot of the times when I work on big projects, I boil them down into actually like a very simple pitch. There's like one, it's really just one thing I'm trying to do. And then the way I frame it to Patrick, who's the one I ask for money, when I tell him like, hey, we're going to direct some studio budget on this experiment. And I always tell him that, you know, I'm going to need some amount of time to figure out if this is even feasible. So I never say, you know, give me a 8 month budget or a 12 month budget for this project, which I can for sure deliver to you at this time. I say, give me a few months and then I will start to know how long it will take to execute. With Oath, the very simple thing, the very like kernel of the idea was, I think I want a board game where the end state is a viable start state. That was it. And Patrick immediately recognized that even though this sounded like a simple premise, it was sort of like fiendishly difficult because games fall into two categories as little, if we're thinking about games as like little systems or engines, they all fall into two categories. And some engines are filled with entropy and they run out of energy. And some engines are they move towards perpetual motion within the game space, right? So Catan, as you play Catan, by the time you get to the end of Catan, the game is producing so many resources that there is no way for the game to eat the resource. Like the players outgrow the design of the game because the game is so fecund, right? And other games like chess, by the end of a game of chess, most of your pieces are dead or captured. And they can't spend energy anymore. The board has kind of exhausted its action potential. Neither one of those games produces a continuing state. the game's over. And so as we got into Oath, the opening premise was like, okay, well, how do we get around that problem? And so as we were thinking about the design, I was thinking about like, okay, well, what parts of the game are going to be healing, restoring itself, reorganizing itself to kind of make that possible? Now, that's a very mechanical answer, but it's with Oath, it's very difficult to tease out the mechanical from the thematic because they are so closely linked. And I'll give you another example of that. When I was thinking about the theme of the game, I was spending a lot of time thinking about stories that take place over 1 to 3 generations, because I was thinking a lot about Brodel and thinking about like Longdurée and just the appropriate scale for history when it comes to board games. So this is the other big question, because if I'm going to make a game about history, it might seem like the obvious thing to do is to make a civilization game. After all, you know, most of those have like a Cleopatra and Napoleon on the cover or something, and a rocket ship and someone like, you know, riding on a papyrus. But that is a very weird, like, I think Sid Meier's has done like more harm and good to like people's sense of history, because history really occurs on this like very generational level. I mean, really, your and I, our contact with history is less us encountering like a 1,000-year-old manuscript in a library and more like a conversation with a grandparent. Like, that's the place where history and our human scales are kind of like actually having contact. And so I started thinking about a game that was generational and what kinds of narrative possibilities are there within the kind of near focus of like a generational story. This actually led me to like reading a lot of fantasy novels that have generational scopes, or even like the scope of a single life. And what I realized was there were all these tropes that kind of kept coming up. One of them was an object that is like lost, but like not truly lost. And so that then created these categories, which is like, we have the world. And then we have the world. That's a big circle. And then within that circle, there is the world as we see and perceive. And then there are other categories like outside of the world. But critically, because we're only perceiving a small portion of the world, we don't know what's truly in the world and what is no longer relevant. I mean, and this is a classic question of politics, right? Which is like, to what degree are we haunted by the past or not haunted? And what, you know, and of course, it's a complex mix of all those things. So now let me, those are kind of high-minded historiography, but let's talk about the mechanical demands that then immediately places on the design. So imagine you're playing a game with a deck of cards. And because I'm a game designer, we'll start with a 52 deck of cards in our imagination, which is about what Oath's deck is. Surprise. Now, in this deck, this is the world. This is everything that could exist in the world. But I don't want players to experience everything that's in the world, because that would be ahistorical and odd and strange. So let's say they experience half of this deck. Okay, great. Now, it's important that they experience half this deck too, because it means that they could see something and then they could not see it for a generation or two, and then it could come back. So that like exile and return dynamic of an object has to require that a deck is not fully utilized. And then if the world should change, so we have a deck of 52 cards and some portion of it's changing, but if it changes too dramatically, I mean, this gets a little bit into the ship of Theseus. Like, we don't want the world to change too quickly or it won't be the same world. We need to be slowly changing it. And so, you know, I went through, you know, just numbers and thought, eventually settled on like, well, 6 cards are going to go out and 6 cards are going to come in. And the deck will stay roughly the same size. And of those cards that come in, well, there's a chance that they'll be in the deck that you see. There'll be a chance that they kind of come back. So that allows you to like have an impact and then not actually see the impact that was had for 2 or 3 games. Now, all of that was actually figured out like within a couple months. So when I told Patrick I wanted to experiment on this design, that was really what I was doing. I was trying to figure out like, what is the speed of the world? What's the player's experience with the world? And at the end of that summing, I realized that I had created a really awful problem for myself, because I had to design this big game with lots of different things I wanted to put in the game, but it had to work in basically 25 cards, which is half, let's say half a deck, 26 cards. And that is not that many cards. If you think about like a button shy 18 card game, that's a lot of work to do in really very, very few cards. And that then creates the, like, all the different puzzles of Oath. Now, you asked a big question, which is how then, like, what are the places where the game starts to fail and stumble? And I think the biggest place where it starts to stumble has to do with the width of the game's political imaginary. The game relies a lot on fantasy tropes, but also I wanted it to be a really interactive game. So it's going to prime violence. It's kind of, you know, force is going to be very important in how the game works. But that kind of means the game can only speak in force. Everything has to be at some level reduced to a battle. In the way that, you know, that's how fantasy novels end. You know, they end with these big battles, right? And that's because it's the thing that connects all the different spheres. And the notable fantasy books are ones that don't quite manage it, right? That find other ways of framing the narrative so that it doesn't need to end in a battle. And so I think that as I was kind of like thinking about how to design in this small space, I started from a very pack style framework that really emphasized state and violence. And there might have been other frameworks that could have been added to that soup, which is something that we're kind of trying to explore. Anyway, that's a very big answer to your question.
I like big answers. Actually, there's one role that I kind of want to talk about just because I've been thinking about it in my own work with Oath right now. And that is the role of citizen. I feel like in a number of games that I play, the Chancellor never really wants to make a citizen. Very few people want to be a citizen. I find that citizenship is a very troubling concept in Oath on the ground. And so has that turned out differently from the way that you intended? Am I just playing it wrong? Or,
This is interesting.
Yeah, I guess just like, where do we go with that social role? Like, what did you intend for it? How have you seen it play out in other people's real games? And, you know, what next?
The question of citizenship often hinges upon how much players come to care about the world that they're building. And the game, I think, to its advantage and disadvantage, doesn't give players a lot of reasons to necessarily care about the world, but players might invest in that world. And by the world, I mean just the collection of cards, which is going from one game to another. Sometimes players who play a lot of role-playing games will get really attached to players and places, to the sites and places that happen to make up like the kingdom of the game. And they will actually want to preserve that world as much as they want to win. And the citizen role exists to make that possible. And so other groups, and I'll even put my own group in this mix, don't care so much about that. And we did an interesting meta thing where I was talking to a group and they were asking me about Oath as a tournament game. And I was like, this is nonsense. It's not one. But I said, you know, the one way that you could think about it is you should record persistence of dynasty and persistence of kingdom. So, and what I mean is if the empire is staying, if no exiles are winning, then the state is continuing. And if a player wins, if they're a citizen, that's a new dynasty, and every chancellor win increases the length of a dynasty. And exile wins always restart dynasties. And then I told them, imagine that you are getting kind of your meta victory points from founding a kingdom that lasts a long time. And in that context, it really changes the game because now I found this empire. I'm the chancellor for a game or two. So that's my initial dynasty. And then it's looking bad. I plead and beg and I bring in those citizens because I would rather have the empire continue than my own dynasty continue. And so that's how it's supposed to work. But it often doesn't work because I think the victory impulse is a lot stronger and the game doesn't signpost that as an option. This is exactly the kind of space that I'm exploring right now with ARCs, and it's the space that I'm exploring with some of the new expansion materials that I'm drumming up. You know, there were versions of Oath long ago where all players began as citizens, and so you always started inside the metropole. And they were interesting, but like didn't quite work. The biggest problem is like the game just kind of needs exiles. It needs that like outer force pushing in to really like hum. And so we found that it was just better to have the player positions like go from game to game. But Arx is actually the opposite. And Arx is as a very narrow starting subjectivity, where Arx is a similar frame to Oath with a couple major differences. But one of the things that's similar about it is you have this kind of like, you know, space, empire, state thing. And the players at the beginning of Game of Arx are all of the same class. They have all kind of like returned from their grand tours. They've got ideas, and then the game opens, but they're all on the same side. And it manages this because there are these like blighted worlds that are slowly messing everything up. There's a good like player versus environment tension right at the very start. And there are other reasons why Arx works the way it does, but Arx got the other version of that framing. I think the thing that I'm trying to explore in one of the Oath expansions is I do think Oath needs more persistence of players. And so this actually gets into like part of the, you know, every design is like a gambit. You're always making bets about what you think is going to work and not work. And in Oath, I decided that like it's a legacy game, but it doesn't care about players because players can drop in and out. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that like nobody wants that really. Because people who experience these games play with the same group of people. And so you don't actually have a lot of people dropping in and out. And there was actually a middle ground where you could say, well, what you could have people drop in and out, but you could also have people stick around. And so one thing that I'm looking at is finding ways of building that like dynasty family framework more directly into the game so that, you know, every color isn't just a color. It's like a family. And potentially we would include like some other colors so that if you know, Jerry always plays blue, but they're not here this week. So we're going to, you know, we're going to keep blue like off to the side. And then that lets people think a little bit about the status of those families, right? This is a family that has been citizens for a long time. I don't just want to become exiled because maybe I'm going to lose all of these like lineages that are associated with our position. And I think part of the problem in Oath, and this is in a lot of fantasy games, is that when we're designing, we don't like friction. We want to lessen our points of friction with our players. But of course, the world is full of friction. Friction is good. Pamir works only because players can't freely determine their loyalty. There has to be an opportunity. And so in that same way, like I wish that the player positions of Oath had more friction, not less.
Ooh, that's a really interesting take on this. I like this conversation about, I guess, helping people invest in to become more attached to the world. Because it is true, like there are certain cards that you see often and they come up and you're like, yeah, it's you again. Hey, buddy. Or, you know, there's certain locations that everybody ends up kind of spatting over because it's just, I don't know, everybody's favorite. But that doesn't consistently happen, and the win instinct is strong. I think it's very interesting to think about things in terms of dynasties and in terms of maybe established citizenship, like maybe a role in the society that you've come to value. But it also leads back to an earlier thing you mentioned, which is that, you know, violence is so inherent to the system of the game. And you mentioned that exiles are kind of needed to create the tension in the game that kind of runs it. So how do you get yourself out of that if you ever do?
I mean, this is the big and unanswered question about this set of materials. I have an operating principle for the Oath expansion, which is basically most expansions look at the core game as a foundation on which to build, which is a good way of thinking about it in most cases. And with the Oath expansion, I'm instead thinking about Oath as a branch of a larger tree. So like the Oath Chronicles of Empire and Exile, you know, 2020, whenever the game came out, that's one branch. But you could further branch away from that spot, or you could go back closer to the trunk of the tree. And so one way that this then manifests itself in the game's mechanisms is that you would say, okay, this victory condition is all about controlling the most sites. Maybe there are other variants of that victory condition that kind of meditate on that theme. Or, you know, this victory condition is all about the darkest secret. And in this particular world, the darkest secret is something that can be seized through force. But maybe there are other versions of the darkest secret that cannot be seized by force, not so easily. Now, where this is going to get a slightly messy is it will require some rewriting, some adjusting of the game's core logic to make room for other ways of interacting. And I don't know what that's going to be necessarily, because I'm deep in arcs. And, you know, really a lot of my dissatisfaction with this element of Oath was funneled directly into arcs, because arcs basically is a kind of a meditation on asymmetric, like the limits of asymmetric design, because asymmetric design is so powerful. It's expensive, but it's powerful, because you can start to understand true difference in player position, which is of course a fundamental element of history and storytelling. Is players have different subjectivities, they have different motivations, and the stories come at the points of contact with those differences. And so asymmetry gets you closer to that, which is great. It costs a lot of rules, which isn't so great. But one problem is that if you want players to really speak, they have to be able to speak the same language. And oftentimes in Root, for instance, that's the language of warriors on the map and the language of throwing dice. So, you know, Root's big innovation in the asymmetric game space was saying, okay, what if everybody can move in battle? And there are these core rule and craft, and there are these like core systems which all players are participating in. The problem is those systems are all martial in nature. And one of the things that I try to do with arcs, and we'll see if it works. I mean, I think every, you know, it wouldn't be fun if I were doing safe projects, and arcs is about as weird as anything. Arcs's big innovation basically is to say, we're going to use an abstracted action structure that turns every interaction into like a little bit of an action auction, basically. But if I'm trying to evacuate a planet and you're trying to cure a disease and someone else is trying to like found a state, we are all competing and interacting in the same shared space through the game's card play dynamics. And that then allows our asymmetry to really like blossom and grow much farther than Root, much farther than even something like Vast. And Oath probably won't get anything that dramatic, but part of me thinks that if I step back and look at Oath's action structure, like if I were to add one action, or if I were to revise how a couple actions work, that might be enough to like widen the space as big as it needs to be.
I can actually see that being the case, because Oath, one of the things that surprises and interests me about the game so much, especially through just repeated play and repeated consideration of it, is that it's so simple, really. Like, yeah. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it does a whole lot with just like a whisper of a set of mechanisms. And I find that fascinating. But that also means that even the tiniest changes can have like a pretty wild butterfly effect on this game, I think. Mm-hmm. Like even the presence of a certain relic or not in your world can really change a lot.
There is a funny, I want to say something about the game's simplicity, because Oath's combat rules are tricky. But it's really the only part of the game that's tricky. Like everything else is like extremely straightforward. And even the combat is straightforward. It's just the exceptions are really expensive. Like, again, it's the fact, like, it's honestly, it's the citizenship rules is what Josh would say. It's like, that's the fundamental thing that's tracking it. And so I actually think if we can trim or adjust the way combat works a little bit, we're going to free up the space to do whatever else we might want to do.
Ooh, that's a really interesting thought. And I guess I kind of want to ask, like, as we think about expanding Oath, is this going to be something that's more like, isn't it going to be expansion, or are we looking at something that's more like, you have a tendency that I personally like, but is rare in board games, to go back to things that you have made and just rework them utterly. So Pax Premier and John Company have both benefited from that in really incredible ways.
Yeah, that's, I think, you know, my intent with Oath is to not do a second edition, which I think it's a way that it could be done. But I also think, I mean, and also this is going to be a little bit of a question for next year, but like, I'll talk a little bit about how decisions around second editions and expansions are made a little bit on the back end. So Second editions are very useful for moments when a design has kind of like gathered some dust and you need to make a decision about a print run. And then you kind of say like, all right, we could reprint this game, or it's been long enough that we can actually go in and kind of fully reimagine it. So in the case of Pamir and John Company, the second edition was something that was decided like very early. Like we had an opportunity to reprint Pamir that we didn't take because we were like, no, I think let's wait a little bit and do a second edition. A similar kind of exercise is happening right now with Vast, where everyone at the studio likes Vast. We all want to do more Vast. And there is demand for us to reprint it. If we were to reprint Vast, we would certainly sell it. But I think there's a sense that like it would be a lot better for the design if we were to do a second edition of Vast, and it would be a really good project for kind of everyone. With something like Root, it's impossible because Root sells so consistently and has such a lively audience that there's really like no opportunity to do a second edition, and there's no reason to. With Oath is more like Root. There is like, we actually see very stable and healthy sales. We have a good stock of it. And so then as I'm thinking about the changes that I want to make for the game, I have to be a little bit more strategic because I can't just go in there and like rearrange everything. Instead, I have to say like, okay, let's imagine we do additional Oath content. And then there's this really fun consideration, which is something I'd never thought about really 5 years ago, which is thinking about what does the Oath line look like? Like for someone who's going to buy a copy of Oath, what are their options? And like, well, you can buy a journal, you can buy like, you know, some card sleeves or whatever. But if you're going to like buy an expansion, is this expansion one product? Is it two? I mean, do we, for instance, have an expansion that's like, this is Oath as like, we're going to introduce like the player legacies as an expansion. And this is another thing that like has a more dramatic chronicle phase. Or do we package it as kind of an omnibus, like Prophecy of Kings? There's like a lot of different ways that an expansion can look. My sense is that in order to make a lot of this stuff work, we're going to be in a kind of D&D 3.5 situation where I'm guessing it'll be like one or two slightly bigger expansions that are meant to work together and that are for both people who've played a lot of Oath, but also people who have been like, you know, if you bought a copy, what I would love, my like dream is someone bought a copy of Oath and it sat in shrink and they like loved the idea of it, but they never played it because they got a little worried. And then we have something to offer them that says like, hey, this is actually going to help you better understand and get excited about this thing and be able to explore it. I mean, the other thing I'll mention here is that, you know, when we're thinking about our work at Leader, especially, we're really interested in like sustaining audiences and then tooling ourselves to helping those audiences continue to explore something that we think is valuable. And Oath is definitely demonstrated there's a sustaining audience. So we are like, we want to like return that, you know, that enthusiasm.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I want to talk about two kind of larger concept things as we discuss Oath. The first I want to talk about is kind of Oath's relationship to fantasy literature, and then I want to talk about how all of that can be serious commentary about history. Sure. So as part of my research for this, I'm actually really glad that I ended up reading, it's Lloyd Alexander's Chronicle. Is it Prydain? Is that how you say it?
I would say Prydain, but...
Chronicles of Prydain?
Sure.
But... you know, starting with the Book of Three, I read that whole series. I devoured that series. At least just so for those of you who have not read The Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander, I highly recommend it. It's like a set of five little middle grade fantasy novels that are the most charming thing. I'm actually going to put them in my classroom and see if I can get kids to pick them up. But
yeah, they are charming.
They're great. They were just great. You know, I thought it might be kind of fun to talk about the ways in which that lore influence appears throughout the world of Oath, starting with Henwen, the pig. Mm-hmm. So that little pig is an oracular pig, everyone.
But, yes.
But there's just so many fun little Easter eggs. To what extent do you still see the Chronicles of Prydain when you look at Oath? Or is it one of those things where it was kind of a distant influence and you just kind of see little echoes and it's fun?
So the Chronicles of Prydain, I had read many years ago. In fact, one of my first like book reports for class was on the High King, which I definitely did not read, but picked off the shelf as a, well, I mean, I think that there's something funny about like, I'll do a 90s kid sound off here. There weren't a lot of like fantasy books in libraries when I was growing up.
No.
So it did a weird thing. Like my kids right now are obsessed with like fantasy graphic novels and like don't really want to read chapter books. And I could be like, you know, come on guys, read chapter books. You're old enough. But actually what has happened is I had to skip to The Hobbit in Redwall because there wasn't anything else in my age category.
Yes. Oh my God. Redwall. That was big for me too.
Right. And, yes. And where's the kids? It's like, no, actually there's a lot of stuff that's actually more age appropriate because there's just, YA fiction is in such a great spot. So The High King was like, I mean, these books are from the 60s. It was one of those books like on the shelf. And I was like, ooh, a person with a sword. And I remember reading it, not really even knowing it was part of a series, attempting to write a book review of it. And then I reread them a little bit later and I'd liked them. And Kyle and I often talked about them because there's something, I mean, there's a lot of remarkable things about them. So one, Lloyd Alexander is a very good writer, and these books are so well structured. Like there's a lovely, I think it's like a slate piece or something that like talks about the Chronicles of Prydain and describes them as like oaken. Like they're just like, they're wonderful to read aloud. They have this like fabular, like very simple, clean storytelling quality that makes them so wonderful to read. I've read them all to my children.
They feel older than they are.
Like yes.
Something primal about them. Yeah.
Right. For sure. And they're also like, the narratives are not really glitzy. I've been reading these British children's books from the 1930s and 40s called The Swallows and Amazons books, which I'm obsessed with and could like have a long, I could talk for like 5 hours about The Swallows and Amazons books. but they have a similar kind of quality, which is like very straightforward storytelling, like almost sleepy and boring, but like extremely compelling at the same time. And like all you're listening to is like the story of like some kids finding a cave or something. And unlike the Hardy Boys, they don't really get sensationalist. And so I think that they're, or you know, I get to have Nancy Drew's books too. Anyway, the Prydain books, Kyle and I had both read. And I think when we were working on Oath, we did a really interesting exercise where I said like, okay, well, here's a game. I want us to be on the generational level. And so that means when players play a lot of games, I don't want the world to go from ancient Rome to the space age in 10 games. I want it to go from like a theme in like Eastern Byzantium, like from like in 700 to like 1100 or like 1050 or something. So the world should be changing, but not quite changing like so dramatically. So we were trying to find like the right setting to have a deep history. One of the problems that like, if we would have done a science fiction setting, one of the problems is that like things change. Right. That's part of the fun, right? You get to see like the Star Wars movies and then you go watch the prequels and you're like, the production design of these movies is neat because they're trying to do like the Art Nouveau, like what does the industrial stuff look like, you know, 50 years, 30 years beforehand. But a critical element is that like things are changing in really big ways. And I was like, well, no, because part of the problem is all these cards are shuffling in to a deck, which means if we're building like a tableau, just like a tarot spread, we have a little Celtic cross, and we're going to like flop out our little cards. They need to look like they belong in one world and not like, you know, some goofy tech, you know, like I always think about like Through the Ages when you like draw a card and you're like, why is this card in this part of the game? Or I've been playing this silly real-time strategy board game called Time of Empires, which is a scream. But every once in a while, you'll be like in like a war, like a modern war, and you'll flip a card and be like, oh, these are like my flint nappers that are still, somehow they're like still in my deck. That doesn't really make sense. So as we were stewing on this, Kyle suggested, well, like, what about fantasy as a possible setting? And Kyle was the one who suggested that the suits should be like cultural aspects rather than peoples, which I thought was really smart. And so Kyle made this chart, and it's just a sketched out chart, and it has all of the suits, his proposed suits, and then levels of like development and engagement from like 0 to 5 or 0 to 6. And he just kind of did it as a thumbnail. So you're like, okay, here's like a little Discordy demon. It gets really, really big. And here's like the little arcane, and here's like a space observatory at like their highest level of realization. And like those all sit like a world. And then as part of this conversation, we start talking about Prydain. Because one of the things that is so remarkable about Prydain, I mean, the books are remarkable for like a million reasons, but one of the things I adore about them is the world is old and arcane, but in ways that like at some level don't matter. Like in Lord of the Rings, the world is old in ways that do matter.
Right.
But in the Prydain books, the world is old in kind of an unfathomable way. And you know, the main character, he wants to kind of like be in this heroic role. And then part of the trick of the books is realizing that like the everyday objects that he encounters actually are important. Like that pig isn't just a pig, and yeah, his teacher isn't just like a teacher. And those like heroic valences of the everyday, to me, it's like the thing that is remarkable about the Prydain books fundamentally is that they are democratic. They are like thinking about how do you tell these stories in a way that emphasizes an ordinary world instead of an extraordinary world. And which is why Tarin Wanderer is the best.
It was definitely the best one. So for those of you who have not read the series, Tarin Wanderer is very coming of age. The only thing that bothers me is that his female counterpart, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Her name is Aelonwy. I don't know.
Aelonwy, yeah.
But I feel like she doesn't get as good of a character arc as he does, frankly. Correct, yeah. But
She's like a remarkable creation for the time and is very good in like the early books.
Yeah.
But her book is like a little weak, and it's sad that she doesn't get especially in the High King. The High King, I think, it's the one my kids like the most. It's exciting.
Yeah.
But it's also like kind of the weakest one.
But Tarin Wanderer is the best one because I love your point about the extraordinary from the ordinary, because, you know, Tarin, he's an assistant pig keeper from book one. He wants to be a hero, and he has to kind of go through this process where he's growing up. He's learning about what other people do that is important. He's developing skills, and he's confronting his parentage in ways that are really meaningful. Like, it's just so wonderful to watch him, like, I guess, become a man who is worthy of all the things he thought he wanted, but not get there in the way that he thought he would.
And like some of that comes from like the way the book engages with like leadership as like an actual concept. Like, yeah, in this, I didn't realize it was funny reading that book to my kids like in 2019 or 2018 when I was working on Oath. I was shocked at how few books like really talk about leadership. Like, okay, I'll pick on Lord of the Rings, which is actually another big, I read all the history of the Middle Earth while working on Oath, all like 4,000 pages of it. And it was fascinating. and I learned a lot about how those books work. But in Tolkien stuff, it's like, Aragorn, he's a leader of men. Look at him lead. And it like doesn't really talk about leadership. Like, the quality of leadership is often taken as like, it's as innate as hair color or something, often with the same racist overtones.
Yeah.
And in the Prydain books, leadership is something that is complex. And like, so much attention is spent on like, you need to understand what failure is like and how failure works and how like leadership means not being an expert. And yes, there's this like lovely moment in Tarin Wanderer where he's confronting the fact that like there's something he wants to do, but he's not good at it.
Yeah. And I was deeply moved.
Yes. Yes. and recognizing that like, no, that leadership aspect, like it is actually its own kind of skill and it has something to it. So it's funny because, you know, so we have all, oh, this filled with Easter eggs relating to the Prydain books, but it was never like a Prydain fan project because we were trying, like, I think Kyle and I were just vibing on it. We were like, this is the kind of world where you don't know how old it is. We're not going to seek to answer that because we want the players to be inhabiting it. Like someone asked me if there was a lore source book for Oath, and I said, no, it's like your first five games are the lore source book. Like you have to, you know, you have to assemble that stuff yourself, right? Because in keeping with that kind of democratic spirit, I want players to be like writing their own lore, because like Oath is a very storytelling forward game, but I wanted the players to be the ones doing that authorship. Now I'll contrast that to two other things. Arx is completely the opposite. Arx, I have a 30,000 word like source book that I wrote that is like, this is how the world of Arx works. There are like a lot of rules and the storytelling is a lot more structured, but it's because Arx is more of a cultivated story. That's like, it like needs it in order for it to work. It like starts kind of in media res. And the other game I'll contrast to, which I think this is a really interesting, it's like one of my favorite titles from the last few years, but it's Ross Cowan's The City of Winter, which is a fascinating, it's an RPG kind of, it's an RPG in the genre of like The Quiet Year and his earlier Fall of Magic, which is to say it's an RPG that it's an RPG for people who don't normally play RPGs, because it's very like careful about table talk and careful about prompts, so that I play City in Winter with people who do not play RPGs. And I think it's my most moving game experience this year was playing City of Winter. City of Winter is amazing because I don't think Ross played Oath, but he was working on City of Winter at the same time as I was working on Oath. And they're the same project as approached from two completely different perspectives. Because City of Winter is all about you play a family that's running from something awful. The Umbra, it's called, but it could be anything. And every phase of the game, what happens is you share traditions and memories, and then you pick up new ones that relate to the place where you are, and then eventually you decide to move on, and because the bad thing's coming, and you just slowly watch the culture of your little group change. And as you like, it has these brilliant rules, like characters age, they have these like little age dots, and they can hold on to as many memories as they have age dots. And then when they get to old age, they start losing those dots, and you have to like, you like share a memory, and if nobody picks it up off the table, it gets lost. And it's like, and then when you lose your last age dot, your character dies. But because you're not, you just make another character. And it is so powerful and so moving. And then you eventually arrive at, it's like, and all of that is like the prologue. You do that over two or three sessions, and then you arrive at the City of Winter, which is like this big city, big metropolis with public transit and everything. And then you kind of encounter a very different way of cultural recombination. And it's incredible. It's an incredible design, done with basically no rules. I mean, not no rules. It certainly has rules to it, but I really like its storytelling approach. And it's something that, you know, Oath is more of a game. It's more stately and more competitive, certainly. And there are advantages to that. So Oath to me, like Oath can speak in dynasties, and it can tell those sorts of stories. But for the, you know, other kinds of stories, the City of Winter is great. So it's my high recommendation.
Oh man, that really sounds good. So I want to connect all of this. So I think one of the reasons that I enjoy talking to you so much is that I think we have a lot in common in the sense that we're both people for whom a game can't just be a game. Mm-hmm. It has to like mean something. And I think that that's very connected to our backgrounds in history. So we talked about all this fantasy and even reading fantastical history, but how does your, I guess, leader game self creating something like Oath also reflect your historian self who's doing things like what Whirligig is making, and how does it come out in Oath?
So some of it is an approach to the work where when I start working on a product, the first thing I do is like pile up books and pile up games and just try to think about, what is this game actually about? Who else has done anything about it? Can I learn from that? Like I sort of think in lit reviews, just from the perspective of labor, really. Just like how do I tackle a big project? I don't know. I'm sure other people have tried to do it before. Maybe I can learn from them. But in terms of approach, what I like about working on projects with Leader is it gives me access to allegory and metaphor in ways that the history games don't quite. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about Root, one thing I adore about working on Root is that I can think about a political problem and then I can try to abstract it. Like, it lets me like play like kitchen philosopher a little bit, because I can say like, okay, well, like, I want to see Locke and Hobbes like fight. I want to like see like what happens if you put John Rawls and John Locke in a cage. Like, who's going to win, or what are the tensions that are going to be exposed by that conflict? And that's hard to do in a history, because in a history you are bound by a case study. You know, you're like bound by the fundamental realities on the ground. You can bend them, but there are a lot of requirements and a lot of strictures that you have to place on yourself if you're being truly rigorous. With something like a Leader project, it allows me to practice a different kind of rigor. And it's a rigor that is a little bit more fantastic and imaginative. And also just tremendously fun. In the same way that I think like writing a novel is different than writing like a biography, right? And that's really sort of what it is. Like, if you're writing a piece of historic fiction or a fantasy, like, you can be deeply researched. I mean, I think about like R.F. Kuang's Babel.
Oh man, I love that book. Did you finally read it?
I might be like halfway through. I'm getting through. I finally got it like seriously underway, because I started this book, for context for the viewers, many months ago, and then it like literally fell behind my bed. And I was like gone for a week. I came back, I was like, where's Babel? I'm like, I don't know, I'll start reading something else. It's been recovered, I'm now underway. But but the thing is, you can read a book like that, or you can read like Jemison's
The
Broken Earth books, which I adore. Yes. Books that are deeply about our own world and deeply like enmeshed in questions of like history and society and politics and philosophy and all the rest. But are also imaginative and kind of freely combined. I mean, actually, so I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I am I like attend the Church of Kim Stanley Robinson. I'm like obsessed with Robinson's work. He's like probably one of my favorite living authors. My brother and I are always reading like a Robinson sci-fi novel. Like, we have like a perpetual, I'm always reading a Pynchon novel and a Robinson novel. Those are like, that's my baseline reading practice are always those two books.
I have read none of this guy's books. It's got to happen now.
Okay. So read Aurora. Aurora is the one I always recommend people start with. It's the one on the generation ship. So what I love about Robinson. So Robinson, I think he was like one of Frederick Jameson's students. And then he went off and had like a career in sci-fi. And what is amazing about Robinson is, I mean, I will tell you how I got introduced to his writing. I was reading a New Yorker piece on something unrelated. And then they made this comment about like, you know, a Tolstoy for our own moment. And then in parentheses, they were like, and if anyone has that title, it's Kim Stanley Robinson, close parentheses. And I was like, what? Who is this author I've never heard of? I love Tolstoy. We have a Tolstoy. I don't know about it. And what I love about Robinson is like a practicing utopian. He is trying to figure out how to make the world a better place. And so as he arranges his novels, he's like, okay, here's a character who like passionately believes in this thing. And here's a character who passionately believes in something different. They both are trying to make the world a better place. And in my novel, we're going to have them argue and we're going to have them sort out and fight. And it's going to be, you know, it'll be interesting. There'll be interpersonal elements to it. And then we're going to see kind of what shakes out. And so he really looks at fiction as a space to sort out ideas that matter, like on like a real, like, you know, in that Tolstoyan, like, let's actually sort through this. And so it's never like, I hate calling him a political novelist, because it's never preachy. He doesn't know the answers. He's trying to like figure out the right framing of the discourse. So his famous books are like the Mars books, which are about the terraforming and building of a world. And if you find yourself exhausted by Mars board games, but would like to think about something that actually like feels like the thing that it's supposed to be about, the Mars books are great. But the one I always recommend is Aurora, which is, it's a generation ship book, but it starts like four generations in on the generation ship, where here's a ship full of people going to a world that none of them agreed to go to because their parents all agreed. And just like thinking through, like, we're on this like tin can going to this place that we don't know if we should be even going there. And it's a beautiful novel. It's fantastic. And yeah, I don't know. His stuff's great, but I really do think like I have felt such a kinship with his narrative practice in working at Leader, because I think about the fantasy games as ways of putting the historical work like into a kind of praxis. And that is really exciting.
Oh man, that's fantastic. I kind of want to talk more about this, but also it's been just about an hour. So I feel like we should cut it here.
Yeah, it's up to you. I can go a little longer.
let's go offline, but we will reprise this conversation, I think, when maybe there's more Oath to talk about. I think that might be actually the best thing to do. But I normally ask people what they're enjoying, but you've given us a fantastic game recommendation. Was it RPG again?
It's called The City of Winter.
Fantastic. And you gave us a great book recommendation, which is
Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora, which is like the one I always feel bad because I love all of his books, but Aurora is my favorite one to start with. Also, a personal note about Aurora, it rescued me from like the worst doldrums of graduate school, like when I was like really low. And then I just happened to pick up a copy of it and was reading it on the bus to and from campus. And it was like, oh, I do love books. I forgot.
It's always good to be reminded. Oh man. Yes, this was awesome. I can't wait to sort of continue this conversation. I see this is something that's like an evolution in process that we'll touch back on it later. But for now, if people want to follow your work, where can they find you?
They can still find me on the site formerly known as Twitter, at Cole Worley. I have a blue sky at the same name. I will use it as soon as they open up their applications. Like I'm, you know, right now it's just work for me to double post, so I don't do it. But as soon as Blue Sky is fully open, I will probably start cross posting there. But yeah, you can find me at Twitter. My DMs are open. You know.
Fantastic. I, of course, am forever online and can be found anywhere as Beyond Solitaire. So please reach out. And everybody, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions. Most of all, happy gaming.